I'm Jewish.
I'm so Jewish.
I'm Jewish.
I'm Jewish.
A lot of people say, I'm Jewish, I'm proud of being Jewish. First thing I ask them is, why?
I'm Jewish. Make something of it.
The first segment with Rabbi Eli Hersher dealt with his bio and what it's like to be the rabbi of a very large congregation. And now we discuss the nuts and bolts of Judaism and the various movements. We go way back to the beginnings of the Reform movement. I thought there was an attempt to bring everybody under one roof and make one denomination for everyone.
Well, you're talking about at the very beginnings of Reform Judaism in America, there was an attempt to... Well, there have been a few attempts. Isaac Meir Wise, who was the founder of the major institutions of the Reform movement in America, created a prayer book that he called Minhag America, meaning the custom, the ritual in America, in which he thought there was no reason to have separate prayer books in the different movements, and made a valiant effort to get his accepted, which it wasn't. And I think understandably that there are real differences within the Jewish community, and so that led to some different ways of worship. And the different movements, well, there was one other attempt. Stephen S. Wise, for whom this congregation is named, in New York, created the Jewish Institute of Religion, and his hope was that rabbinic students would come and study, become rabbis, and then decide whether they wanted to serve in different movements. That is, he felt that all rabbis should have an education that was similar, that rabbis ought to be learning the same things. Why have these different seminaries? But that ultimately didn't work. It ultimately merged with the Hebrew Union College to become one institution for the Reform movement. I am a Reform rabbi serving in a Reform congregation. What that means to me, most significantly, is that within Reform Judaism there is an openness to the entire tradition, and at the same time, with that openness, a recognition that not every Jew is going to live it in the same way or interpret it in the same way. The liberality of Reform for me does not mean I'm a Reform Jew, that means I'm a minimalist. I do the least that's required of me. That's a negative interpretation of what Reform means. It's not what the Reformers meant for it to mean, and it's certainly not what the Reform movement means today. Reform suggests informed choice, not choice based on I'll do what's convenient, I'll do what I want. I'll learn, and based on what I learn from my tradition, from its texts, from its wisdom, and based on what I experience, I'll make significant choices for my life. So that if someone were to say, for example, on an issue like kashrut, observing the dietary laws, many would assume that, and many Reform Jews would say, I'm Reform, I don't do that. I'm Reform, I don't do that. I don't do that is a non sequitur to I am Reform. I am Reform, for me, would mean I'm going to take that seriously as well. I'm going to study the laws of Kashrut and its rationale and see if I can experience it as a mitzvah that I can hear in my life that will deepen my Jewish identity, deepen my observance as a Jew. Reform is not anti-ritual anymore. It was clearly at its beginnings, but it's definitely not today. You walk into this congregation, kippot are on everyone's head. You don't come up for an aliyah without a talit. That's not true in every Reform congregation, but this place has always, from its very beginnings, been very open to all elements of the tradition. What makes it reform and what leads me to the reform movement is an idea, therefore, and it's an idea that's actually in many ways being lived by many Jews already, whether they are in reform congregations or not. And there's a need for the movements for this reason, and that is they offer homes to Jews who find a greater degree of comfort or resonance in one home over another. So that there are people who will move from one congregation to another, often because of what resonates for them there. Having said all of that, I am also inclined, although I told you what I find most meaningful about the Reform idea, and it's more idea for me than movement, I'm also inclined more and more to consider myself to be post-denominationalist. There are Reform colleagues who will appreciate that, others who won't. Where the denominations see themselves as competing with one another, that doesn't resonate for me. Where the denominations don't try to work with each other on behalf of Judaism and the Jewish people, it doesn't make sense to me. I am not one who defends the Reform idea at the expense of any of the other ideas of Judaism. I love the fact that there are Orthodox, conservative, and Reconstructionist and Reform Jews. And while I consider myself to be religious, I love the fact that there are Jews who, as long as they're serious, if they're finding meaning in some kind of secular definition, if their definition of their Judaism is Zionism, but they take that seriously and are engaged in it, I'm pleased that they're there as well. And the divisions in the movements sometimes lead to a certain judgmental quality. That is, Reform Jews who think, well, it's the Orthodox are really the ones who are sustaining Jewish life. They'll be the guarantors of Jewish life in the future. Or Orthodox Jews who say Reform and Conservative are anathema to us, they're assimilationists, that the only true form is Orthodoxy. That, to me, whatever movement it comes from, or it usually doesn't come from movements, it comes from individual Jews, it comes from narrowness. That kind of narrowness, for me, has no place in Jewish life. We're just too small a people to make a point of the divisions. To acknowledge that there are differences in the Jewish community is wonderful. To celebrate them, I think, is wonderfully positive. To use those differences as tactics of division. There's a statement in the Talmud which says that the temple in Jerusalem was destroyed because of sinat chinam, that is, baseless, groundless hatred within the Jewish community. Divisions that didn't need to exist. And the same statement goes on to say, and the temple will be restored, rebuilt, because of ahavat chinam, because of baseless, groundless love, when you don't need a reason to love the other. That second part is a great vision for the Jewish people. And when the denominations are divisive, they're dangerous. And it's at those moments especially that I'm post-denominational, that I just appreciate all of the movements, all of the ideas.
We now refer back to a previous interview we had with an Orthodox rabbi, not Rabbi Reinman, but somebody else. And this particular rabbi said he loves all Jews. He wants to hug all Jews, especially the non-Orthodox, but he can't pray with the non-Orthodox. So if you love someone but you can't pray with them, is that a contradiction?
To an Orthodox rabbi or an Orthodox Jew who says, I can't pray with you in your synagogue, is actually a response of understanding. Because and that same Orthodox Jew may say, I want to hug all Jews, but I won't pray with them. There are those who would be very critical of that. I'm not, because I understand that within an Orthodox interpretation of Jewish law, there are particular ways of praying and words that have to be said. Given that in a more liberal Jewish environment, certain of those words won't be said. And some other difficulties as well, whether it's women and men together, various differences. I respect those differences. I don't believe that Orthodox rabbi you spoke to who said he'd like to hug every Jew, I believe him, and I want to hug him in return. We don't have to pray together. I think we can learn together. I don't think there's anything. I study with Orthodox rabbis at the Hartman Institute in Jerusalem. They're within the liberal end of modern Orthodoxy, to be truthful. But all of the rabbis who participate in this learning together have grown because of the sharing of learning simply with other Jews, with other rabbis, no matter what the movement is that they come from. I don't think that denominational differences will keep us from learning together. I don't think it'll keep us from a common love and support of Israel and Jews worldwide. I think we can work together on just about everything. Prayer is more complicated because of certain halachic legal restrictions that I'm not bound by, but that I appreciate an Orthodox rabbi is bound by. And therefore, I'll understand when he or his kids won't pray with me in my synagogue.
The Central Conference of American Rabbis, which is the reform group, adopts various platforms from time to time. And now we talk about the Pittsburgh platform of 1999. There was a Pittsburgh platform in 1885, and he references it, but we're talking about the most recent one and his thoughts.
The new Pittsburgh platform, or Pittsburgh 2, or whatever it's being called, which came 100 years after the first Pittsburgh platform. And the reason it's given the name Pittsburgh is that's where the Central Conference of American Rabbis met for their convention that particular year, is, I think, a great document. It's a longer document than those that have preceded it. There have only been three that preceded it. It's longer because it's dealing with many issues in greater detail than the previous platforms did. That is, around prayer, around study, around ritual questions. What the platform has done is open itself, really open the reform movement, saying that we're not minimalist. We're not a place that you come to do the least. We're taking this tradition seriously, and some of what we neglected or even discarded, we're taking an entirely new look at it, an openness to it. And we want our congregants to do that and learn with us, so that the reform movement now, since that new Pittsburgh platform, is providing its members with all kinds of new opportunities for learning and new opportunities for observance, and trying to get, I think, Reformed Jews not to define themselves as doing the least, but being open to the most. So that's an encapsulation of what I think, but there's much in there that has value. That's part of the beauty of Reform. that it's not reformed Judaism, past tense. It's reform. It's ongoing. That is, Judaism has always reformed itself, depending on where we lived, depending among whom we lived, depending upon the circumstances of our existence there. We've been influenced by the cultures that we've lived in, and we fought against them as well. We've taken on certain things from American culture, and others, we say, you know, there are boundaries, there are borders as to how much you take on. But a reforming Orthodoxy today is not what Orthodoxy was 100 years ago. And Jewish life in America today, whether it's Orthodox, conservative, or reform, is not what it was 200 years ago in an Eastern European shtetl. We're not in the shtetl any longer. So Judaism continues to grow and develop, based on always a foundation of the past, of texts, and the texts become renewed as well. There's a wonderful statement, there's a great vision of Jewish life. The first chief rabbi of then Palestine, Avram Cook, had a vision of Jewish life. He said the following. He said, Hayashan yitchadesh, the old shall become renewed, v'hechadash yitkadesh, and the new shall become sanctified, made holy. That's a beautiful vision of old and new, past, present, future, where nothing is rejected out of hand, where the old isn't rejected because it's old, it's renewed. You find the spirit in it and help it speak to where you're living today, as opposed to rejecting. And the new is not new for the sake of newness to replace the old. There's room for new in Jewish life. There are things we continue to learn, and we want to sanctify the new. We want to make it as holy as the old. And that is, I think, a vision that still holds. What I love about the way the statement sounds in Hebrew, first of all, there's a rhyme in it, there's a rhythm to it, but there's a movement to it. The verbs that are used are verbs of future. That's why I don't think this is just a vision of the reform movement today. This is a vision of those who I think are thinking most deeply about what needs to happen in Jewish life, particularly in America, have a sense of teach so that you renew what you've received, make it feel like it's entirely new, meaning fully alive, and innovate according to the needs of your community. Make the old feel new to them and take seriously what they bring, what they have to contribute of their own life experience, sanctify that.
We now discuss the circumcision ceremony, which is known as Brit Milah in Hebrew, or a lot of people refer to it as a bris. And we're wondering why it's so common, even for Jews who practice very little Judaism or none at all. You know, why do they still have their 8-day-old boys circumcised? Why is that?
Brit Milah is probably the most powerful of areas of observance in Jewish law, ritual, that has remained constant from the time of Abraham. There are some in the Jewish community who, very few, but small numbers, who say, why do we need that for? It's not a medical procedure that is necessary. And of course, it's not necessary, and from a Jewish perspective, it's not being done as a medical procedure. So that a medical argument against it doesn't resonate for me. It is incredible because even when Jews were living in the Soviet Union, now the former Soviet Union, under rigid restrictions of what they could and could not observe, it was illegal to circumcise their sons, to bring them into the covenant. And there were Jews who, despite that, had their sons at 8 days enter the covenant through circumcision. And had they been caught, they would have been arrested for it, so that they knew the risks involved. And yet, it's a ritual that had significant enough power that you'd be willing to be imprisoned, which was no small thing in the Soviet Union, for performing that act. It was also in the time of the Maccabees, the Hanukkah story, 165 BCE, it was also forbidden by the Hellenizers, by the Syrian Greek world, under penalty of death, as was study of Torah. And yet we know that Jews continued to study Torah under penalty of death, and Jews continued to circumcise their sons and bring them into the covenant. So there's an element of that that goes beyond the rational, much deeper than the rational. The rational would just have said, don't do it, just, you know, don't take those kinds of risks. And I think that the power of it is due to some sense of what it would mean not to do it. Not to do it would mean that you would take that one physically identifying marker of the covenant and lose it, which would be for some to say, I've given up on my identity. Out of fear, or because today someone says that it's not medically necessary. When I think that in that Brit Milah there is a recognition that Jews since Abraham have done exactly the same thing with every newborn child. Its meaning for me is of, you know, why circumcision has to do with the recognition that part of the body is the most physical. That there are impulses in us that can lead to all kinds of behavior of the physical. That circumcision is saying we're adding a dimension of the spiritual. That is, where you are also, you're entering a covenant with your entire body. The fact that it's on the eighth day suggests to me that in 6 days God created the world, on the seventh day God rested. What's the eighth day? Well, the eighth day is the one in which we really enter creation as human beings, where we begin to perfect creation, where we add something that completes. That's the meaning of being part of a covenant, of realizing God's vision for the world. That, the marker of identity, someone suggesting that fear should keep you from being a Jew, I think serves to make it even more powerful. So I'll make it more personal. When my son was born, and there was no question that there would be a Brit Milah on the eighth day, it was an incredibly moving moment for me. It is, I don't recoil at the surgical part of it. People often do, but I think they recoil at it, and it's really a very simple procedure. They recoil at it because they see it purely as physical and don't have any concept of the spiritual dimension of saying, I have a newborn son. whom I am bringing into the covenant between the Jewish people and God. That's what this is about. At the beginning of his life, I'm making a very, very powerful statement by observing that particular mitzvah. And it's at the beginning of a life. That, I think, is another reason that it's so powerful. It's not an everyday mitzvah. It's something you're going to do once, thank God, only once. It raises in our times, and it has for the last generation, the very important question of covenant ceremonies for girls. That is, that to talk about Brit Milah for boys and not to talk about Brit of covenant for girls is not only distasteful, but there's an element of justice missing in that, an element of deep exclusion. And that's why my daughter, when she was born, had a covenant ceremony on the eighth day of her life. That is, we could have waited, since there is no such ceremony traditionally, but wanted to make the statement that this is not less important for a girl than it is for a boy. It is the eighth day of her life, and we're going to make a spiritual statement about her entering the covenant. And various rituals, obviously radically different ones and simpler ones, have been created that are not physical, certainly not surgically physical, that bring girls into the covenant. And that's the new. That's Rav Kook's notion of the new being sanctified. Create, and that's what's possible in liberal movements, in the Reform conservative and Reconstructionist movements, where you say, there's something deeply missing here. A girl has been born, we create a ritual, and then the new needs to be sanctified. Once those rituals are observed for numbers of generations, they will become part of Jewish tradition. I hope as deeply one day as a Brit Milah for a boy. It takes time, but it's very powerful to bring a Jewish girl into the covenant.
Thank you once again to Rabbi Hersher. He is so genuine, and he didn't shy away from any question. We still have two more segments coming up with him, so stay tuned for that. If you like what you hear, subscribe to the show and tell your friends, give us a review, and you can go over to our website for more information. That's whyjudaism.org. whyjudaism.org, and shop at our sponsor, Hazaka.com. That's HAZAKAH.com. Hazaka.com, Jewish games that feed the brain. Thanks for listening.
All right, that's it. Hot as hell, Jay.